gentlemen, distinguished colleagues, and especially to those of you who are visiting the campus this evening, you're very welcome. My name is Hugh Brady, President of UCD. This event is being co-hosted by UCD School of Philosophy and UCD's Clinton Center for American Studies, whose director, Liam Kennedy, you will meet later, and he will chair the Q&A session. I've been given a somewhat impossible task. I've been asked to provide you with a brief but yet adequate introduction for our guest speaker this evening, Professor Noam Chomsky. It has been said that a great thinker is not so much someone whose opinions or ideas we agree with, as someone who compels us in our turn to think. By that standard alone, we're privileged to have Noam Chomsky visit UCD tonight. He is, more than anything else, a man who compels us to think and rethink our fundamental assumptions about language, about the world we inhabit, about the power relationships which constitute and frequently distort the potential of that world. Noam Chomsky first came to the attention of the global academic community through his groundbreaking work in the field of language. His hypothesis of language being grounded on innate biological or genetic endowment continues to influence thinkers in the field today, including those who disagree. For many outside the academic world, Noam Chomsky first came to international attention in the 1960s as a critic of American participation in the Vietnam War. Now, Socrates may have said that the role of the philosopher was to be a gadfly to the powers that be in society. In our own times, it's hard to think of a better exemplar of the gadfly philosopher than Noam Chomsky. If it is the responsibility of the intellectual to insist upon the truth, it is also his duty to see events in their historical perspective. These words of Noam Chomsky, written in 1967, are perhaps the best possible summary of both his own career objectives and trajectory, and of the continuing challenge which he throws down to all responsible citizens. Before concluding, I must say I feel obliged to say a few words of thanks to our colleagues in the Department of Foreign Affairs and the good people of Aer Lingus for getting our distinguished speaker to us this evening. I'm sure Professor Chomsky will take no offense if I say that it was somewhat reassuring for the rest of us to know that even such celebrated figures can run into local administrative issues such as passport maintenance. Without further ado, I give you our distinguished guest speaker this evening, Professor Noam Chomsky.
This is a vain attempt on the part of my wife to keep me honest so I don't go on too long. If it doesn't work, she'll stop me. I have to start, I guess, by thanking the government of Ireland for getting me through an impossible dilemma, which I suppose you know about, but miraculously I'm here, thanks to them and others. The leading scholarly article in a U.S. Scholarly journal on what's called the roots of the Bush Doctrine, that's the title of the article, opens by saying that the promotion of democracy is central to the George W. Bush administration's prosecution of both the war on terrorism and the overall grand strategy. That statement is unsurprising. By the year 2005, it had reached the level of ritual. Sometimes, actually, it's given a broader sweep. So in Britain's leading journal of international affairs, the main article on the Bush Doctrine uses pretty much the same words, but adds that promoting democracy abroad has been a primary goal ever since Woodrow Wilson endowed U.S. foreign policy with a powerful idealist element, reaching particular salience under Ronald Reagan, and has been taken up with unprecedented forcefulness under George Bush number two. In journalism and commentary, this is taken to be the merest truism. It isn't asserted, it's just presupposed as the framework for discussion. Well, this description of the Bush doctrine is obviously of quite considerable importance. It's adopted with a near unanimity, and in that case, a rational person will seek the evidence on which it's based and ask how counter-evidence is dealt with. And actually, the results of an inquiry like that tell us quite a lot about the state of democracy in the United States and the West quite generally. So to take an extreme example, if, say, statements like that appeared in the North Korean press, we wouldn't bother to look for evidence. The evidence is that the dear leader pronounced it, and therefore it's true, there's nothing else to say. In a democratic society, in contrast, one would expect serious efforts to present evidence to support a doctrine of great importance that's adopted with virtual unanimity and the critical analysis of counter-evidence. And the inquiry into exactly how that has worked out is certainly worth undertaking, and I think the results are quite enlightening, at least for people who care about their own countries. Last January, as you know, Iraq held its first elections, and the elections were warmly welcomed by the government of Iran, that is. The foreign minister of Iran declared that Iran supports the wishes of Iraqi citizens for a democratic government, a fully sovereign Iraq, and a stable and peaceful region of democratic states. Very impressive. Rational observers, however, will view Iran's dedication to democracy promotion with a certain degree of skepticism. And the same is true when Bush and Blair and Rice and Straw and so on issue very similar pronouncements. In fact, far more so in this case, for reasons that it takes a certain effort to ignore. The most glaring of these reasons is occasionally articulated, though very rarely, actually, in a considerable survey of scholarly literature. I found it once. Well-known Middle East scholar, Augustus Richard Norton, who commented that as fantasies about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction were unmasked, the Bush administration increasingly stressed the democratic transformation of Iraq, and scholars jumped on the democratization bandwagon. Before the fantasies were unmasked, there was, of course, occasional invocation of the standard pieties about love of democracy, but not beyond the usual meaningless norm. In the most extensive study, scholarly study, of official justifications for the Iraq invasion by intelligence analyst John Prados, terms like democracy are notable by their absence, in fact, not even indexed. Well, to put it plainly, if a little bit impolitely, while asking us to appreciate their eloquent orations about the sincerity of their devotion to democracy transformation, while doing this, the U.S. and British leaders are also informing us quite clearly that they are among the most brazen liars in history. They drove their countries to war, as you know, on grounds of what they insistently called a single question, phrase reiterated over and over. A single question is, will Saddam abandon his weapons of mass destruction programs? By August 2003, the tale was falling to pieces, and the press began to report, New York Times, typical, that as the search for illegal weapons in Iraq continues without success, the Bush administration has moved to emphasize a different rationale for the war against Saddam Hussein, using Iraq as a linchpin to transform the Middle East, and others followed suit. Well, that certainly raises some questions about the significance of the dedication to democracy promotion. In fact, for rational people, that ends the discussion. It undermines the credibility of the different rationale. But that's only the bare beginning. Nonetheless, the new rationale became holy writ. The sincerity of our dear leader passed beyond challenge after the president's address at the 20th anniversary of the National Endowment of Democracy in November 2003. The single question by that time had been deeply buried. It was replaced by Bush's messianic mission to bring democracy to the Middle East, so that the president's Iraq venture may be the most idealistic war fought in modern times. That's quoting from the elite left liberal end of the spectrum. Elsewhere, it's more effusive. With considerable effort, I have found only the rarest of exceptions to this stance in media and intellectual commentary and scholarship, although there are indeed critics. We can find critics. They warn that what they call the noble and generous vision of democracy transformation may be beyond our reach. It may be too costly. The beneficiaries may be too backwards, not yet ready for our benevolent effort to bring them democracy. And actually, evidence for that conclusion was provided just a few days after the president's revealed his messianic mission at the anniversary celebration. A Gallup poll in Baghdad gave respondents the opportunity to jump on the democratization bandwagon, but some failed to do so, 99%. Asked why they thought that the U.S. invaded Iraq, 1% felt that the goal was to bring democracy, 5% felt that the goal was to help Iraqis, and most of the rest assumed that the war was fought to take control of Iraq's enormous energy resources, oil, hydrocarbon resources, and to strengthen the U.S. position in the Middle East and to support Israeli interests. That has a there's a term for that, a technical term for that in the West. It's called a conspiracy theory. Tony Blair has been particularly irate at any hint of such a heresy, and it's derided by rational Westerners who understand that Washington and London would have been just as dedicated to the liberation of Iraq if its resources, if its exports happened to be fresh fruit, and the major energy resources of the world happen to be somewhere, say, in the South Pacific. That's what we must believe, unless we're in Baghdad or most of the rest of the world outside the civilized West. There is a problem trying to explain to backward people how dedicated we are to their welfare. That's an old layback of imperialism, hundreds of years, and it continues. Last September, I'm sure it was reported here, the White House sent a public relations specialist to the Middle East, Karen Hughes, to explain that they just don't understand their sincere dedication to their freedom and their welfare. She had a stump speech. It began with, "I'm a mom and I love kids." And then went on to say how much we love you too. Well, it didn't work very well. It's called public diplomacy, is the name for this. It didn't work very well. And the reasons were explained by the press, by the chief diplomatic correspondent of the New York Times, who followed her, accompanied her on her voyage. as he described it, I'll just quote him, Karen Hughes kept to concise sound bites rather than sustained arguments. And in the U.S., he said, that works. The sound bites come from the president, they're amplified by the media, and if that fails to work, then money can be poured into saturation advertising. By contrast, in quoting still, in the lively and percussive environment of the Middle East, sound bites, media amplification, and saturation advertising don't seem to work. So these primitive people think that sustained arguments and debate and discussion are somehow components of democracy. And therefore, the task of democracy promotion is going to be quite difficult. As far as I can tell, these accounts have no touch of irony. Maybe I'm missing it. You see, it looks to me as though the deterioration of democracy in the United States and the West generally is not only recognized, but in fact is lauded. Another problem that might concern us. Well, quite apart from the timing, faith in the miraculous conversion is a little difficult to sustain in the light of the behavior of the missionaries just moments before. So it's hard to recall any display of hatred and contempt for democracy, which is as clear as the old Europe, new Europe distinction that was announced by Donald Rumsfeld in the shortly before the invasion, and very eagerly picked up by the media and the political class. The criterion distinguishing old and new Europe was extremely sharp and clear. Old Europe, that's the bad guys, were the countries where the governments took the same positions as the very large majority of their population. Whereas New Europe, you know, the hope for democracy in the future, were the countries where the governments overruled even larger majorities of their population and took their orders from Crawford, Texas. Therefore, old Europe is to be disparaged, and New Europe is to be lauded as the hope for democracy and enlightenment. Again, I reviewed it. Conformity was close to 100%. I could barely find a mention of the idea that there's something odd about this. You can check to tell me whether the Irish press commentary was the same. The most honored representative of New Europe was Spain's Prime Minister Aznar. He, in fact, was rewarded for his love of democracy by being invited to join Bush and Blair at the summit which announced the invasion of Iraq. This was very shortly after polls in Spain showed that he was backed in his support by 2% of the population. That was the hope for democracy. The display of hatred for democracy, which again, I can think of no historical precedent for, it reached its peak when the government of Turkey, to everyone's surprise, actually followed the will of 95% of the population and rejected Washington's demand that it provide facilities for the war in Iraq. Colin Powell, who, as you know, is the official dove, was extremely angry. He announced harsh sanctions for this defection from good order. Turkey was bitterly condemned in the national press for lacking what were called democratic credentials. The most extreme position was taken by Paul Wolfowitz. He berated the Turkish military because they didn't compel the government to overrule 95% of the population and follow Washington's orders. And here are his words. And he demanded that the military leaders apologize to the United States and say, we made a mistake. Now let's figure out how we can be as helpful as possible to the Americans, they should say, demonstrating their understanding of democracy. Small wonder that he was designated idealist-in-chief of the administration's David Ignatius, Ignatius. He's a veteran correspondent of the Washington Post, former editor of the International Herald Tribune. Ignatius recognized that idealist extremism, Wolfowitz might have some flaws. He said he might be too idealistic, so much so that his passion for the noble goals of the Iraq War might overwhelm the prudence and pragmatism that normally guide war plans. In an accompanying accolade, Sebastian Mallaby declared that his passion is the advance of democracy. The Financial Times chimed in London and said that has been one of the most consistent themes of his career, and so it continued. All of these tributes and accolades, and there were many, had an interesting characteristic. They scrupulously ignored his record. His record is one of consistent and appalling contempt for human rights and democracy. That's back to the days in the Reagan administration and since. There's no time to run through it, but just to mention one stellar example. He was perhaps the most enthusiastic supporter of General Suharto of Indonesia, and his support persisted even after this grand mass murderer and torturer, who certainly ranks with Saddam Hussein, even after he was abandoned by Washington, when he did commit a crime, his first crime, he dragged his feet on iron measures, and he was failing to control the population. So Madeleine Albright, they informed them that the time had come for a democratic transition in Indonesia, 1998, but Wolfowitz went on praising it. Bush and company continued to pursue the messianic mission in their traditional domains. That's Latin America, the traditional domain of U.S. power. In 2002, right in the midst of when the mission was being formulated, they supported a military coup in Venezuela to overthrow the elected government, but then they had to slink away in the face of overwhelming condemnation in Latin America, where the population also seems to be deficient in its understanding of democracy, and therefore doesn't appreciate the overthrow of elected governments by a U.S.-run military coup. Shortly after the popular uprising in Venezuela overthrew the U.S.-backed military coup, and then the U.S. turned to the next device, namely subversion. Subversion is typically carried out under the guise of supporting democracy promotion. So just give one example. Last September, the United States decertified Venezuela for alleged non-cooperation with the U.S. drug operations in the region. It carries various penalties. However, they didn't completely impose the penalties. I'm now quoting the press. Washington waived the cuts in U.S. foreign aid usually attached to the decertification so that Washington can continue to support Venezuelan pro-democracy groups that oppose the leftist Chavez. Well, that's an interesting comment. So some eyebrows might be raised, for example, if Iran were funding anti-Bush groups in the United States right after having backed the military coup to overthrow the government. But of course, we're different. However, let's put that minor point aside and notice that for the press, it is a logical impossibility that there might be some groups supporting Chavez who are pro-democracy. If you're pro-democracy, you're anti-Chavez. And there's proof for that. The proof is that Washington has so declared, so North Korea style, it's proven. And therefore, it can have no relevance whatsoever that Chavez has repeatedly won carefully monitored elections and referenda, despite overwhelming and bitter media hostility, which probably never can be tolerated in the Western country. and that his popularity runs very high, estimated maybe up to 80%. Nor is it relevant that Latin America's major polling organization recently found that while satisfaction with democracy continues its ominous decline throughout Latin America, incidentally, in striking parallel to the neoliberal programs which are designed to undermine democracy. But despite this steady decline, there are a few exceptions. And leading the list of exceptions was Venezuela, where support for democracy climbed sharply to 75% through the Chavez years. And the country now leads Latin America in support for the elected government. But what Venezuelans think about Venezuelan democracy is plainly irrelevant. Washington opposes the government, and therefore any support for it must be anti-democratic. It's true by definition in a well-run doctrinal system. Again, you might investigate and see if this is an exaggeration. Elsewhere in Latin America, democracy promotion continues in its familiar course. In March 2004, the missionaries were concerned that elections in El Salvador might come out the wrong way. So they warned Salvadorans that if they make the wrong choice, the country's lifeline might be cut. The country's lifeline is remittances from people who do the dirty work in the United States, along with other consequences. And Salvadorans recognized that this is no idle threat, and they elected the right person, so that was an authentic democracy. These perfectly familiar patterns are being followed throughout the world in the normal fashion. For example, in Central Asia, where the Bush administration has been enthusiastic supporters of some of the world's most awful tyrants, torturers, and murderers. Well, the facts are not controversial, they're reported, but there's an explanation for them. Here's an explanation from the New York Times again, which is bemoaning the fact that we're supporting some of the worst monsters in the world. In a region of bases, energy, and big power rivalries, ideals require patience. Therefore, we have to temper our passion for democracy and human rights with deep regret, as the West has been doing for several centuries, just as we have to temper our attitudes toward, should say, torture, so instructed by our leaders, not just in the United States. So last Friday, Dick Marty, the Swiss lawmaker who heads the Council on Europe investigation into U.S. torture practices, rendition and so on, he reported on his inquiries into alleged European participation in the U.S. policies of extraordinary rendition, fancy word for torture, which are in radical violation of international law on human rights. We can say, I'm quoting him, we can say without a doubt that these illegal activities of transporting and detaining prisoners were taking place in Europe, and that European countries have a fairly shocking attitude towards these criminal policies, not just Romania and Poland, to which European powers would prefer to limit attention, but elsewhere. And others may consider their own role and responsibility in that. Well, the strongest witnesses for the defense of the authenticity of the Messianic mission should be the leading scholars and activists who are the most enthusiastic advocates of democracy promotion. And by far the most prominent among them is the director of the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His name is Thomas Carruthers, a well-known scholar. He identifies himself as a neo-Reaganite, meaning he agrees with the British scholarship that Wilsonian idealism took on particular salient under Reagan's leadership. The year after the invasion of Iraq, just after the Messianic mission had replaced the single question, Carruthers published an interesting book reviewing the record of democracy promotion by the United States since the end of the Cold War, from the 90s into the early 21st century. Carruthers finds what he calls a strong line of continuity running through all administrations in the post-Cold War era, including Bush number two. Namely, democracy is promoted by the United States if and only if it conforms to strategic and economic interests. He finds that all administrations are what he calls schizophrenic in this regard, with the puzzling consistency, odd mental disorder that seems never to disappear. Carruthers also wrote the standard scholarly work on democracy promotion in Latin America during the Reagan years, when it took on particular settings. He's actually writing both as a scholar and also from an insider's perspective in that case. He was in the State Department taking part in what were called the democracy enhancement projects. Carruthers describes these policies as sincere, but a failure, and a systematic failure. He's an honest scholar, and he reports it. The systematic failure is that in the regions where U.S. influence was least in South America, there actually was progress towards democracy, though the Reagan administration tried to impede it by supporting right-wing dictators and killers. In contrast, where U.S. influence was greatest in the regions nearby, and progress for democracy was least. And Carruthers gives the reason. The reason was that the United States would tolerate only top-down forms of democratic change that did not risk upsetting the traditional structures of power with which the United States has long been allied in quite undemocratic societies. So in short, the strong line of continuity and the strange schizophrenia goes back a decade earlier to the Reagan years, when the powerful idealist element in traditional U.S. policy gained particular salience, according to British scholarship. Nonetheless, the dedication of our leaders to the principle is beyond question, and today we must believe that Bush is dedicated to the messianic vision of creating a sovereign democratic Iraq and bringing democracy everywhere. In fact, the strong line of continuity goes back much farther. Democracy promotion has always been proclaimed as a guiding vision, but it isn't even controversial that the U.S. regularly has overthrown, as has Britain, parliamentary democracies, often installing, supporting brutal tyrannies, Iran, Guatemala, Brazil, Chile, long list of others, no need to go through it. There were Cold War pretexts, but they regularly collapse on the slightest investigation. In his 2004 book, Carruthers predicted with regret that Washington's Iraq policies would extend the strong line of continuity. As he put it, he feared that they will likely exhibit similar contradictions between stated principles and political reality. And in fact, these predictions were being fulfilled as his book went to press. The occupation authorities, U.S. and British, worked assiduously to try to avert the threat of democracy, but they were compelled with great reluctance to abandon their plans to impose a constitution on Iraq and to prevent elections. There are very few competent observers who would disagree with the editors of the London Financial Times, quote them, that the reason the elections took place was the insistence of the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, who vetoed three schemes by the U.S.-led occupation authorities to shelve or dilute elections. The veteran Middle East correspondent Patrick Coburn adds that it was only when it became clear that the United States could not withstand a Shia uprising that elections turned out to have been an American goal all along. In reality, the elections were a triumph of mass nonviolent resistance, should be an aspiring model to the nonviolent movements in the West in their achievement. They did compel the occupying authorities to allow elections to take place. And of course, once they were forced to take place, they routinely took credit for them in a familiar way. Well, although compelled to tolerate elections by the mass nonviolent resistance movement, the occupying forces at once tried to subvert them. They had a candidate, Iyad Alawi. He was given every possible advantage, state resources, access to TV, support of the military occupation. He ran a distant third with maybe 14% of the vote. To ensure that elections would be truly free, the U.S. expelled the most important independent media from the country, obvious prerequisite for free elections. Notably, the Qatar-based station Al Jazeera, which is despised by the ruling tyrants in the region and by Washington, because it's been the leading force for democratization in the Arab world, which alone makes its presence before elections in Iraq inappropriate. And the background actually tells us a good deal more about the messianic mission. And for years, high officials in the United States, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Powell, Rice, others, have been pressuring Qatar to curtail Al Jazeera's reporting. The U.S. bombed Al Jazeera's facilities in Kabul and Baghdad, killing a Jordanian correspondent there. U.S. pressure was so intense, according, I'm now quoting the New York Times, U.S. pressure was so intense, according to a senior Qatari official, that the government is accelerating plans to put Al Jazeera on the market, though the Bush administration counters that a privately owned station in the region may be no better from their point of view. So we therefore have another demonstration of Bush's noble vision of democracy in the Middle East. No media can be tolerated, whether public or private, that are not under U.S. control. Then we will have true democracy by Western standards. Not novel. Well, what Iraqis think about these matters, can't know with complete confidence, but there's information. On the day of the last January election, international poll was released by Zogby International, one of the main polling organizations, which found that 82% of Sunnis and 69% of Shiites favor U.S. forces withdrawing either immediately or after an elected government is in place. A poll last August by the British Ministry of Defense, a secret that was leaked in the British press, found that 82% of Iraqis are strongly opposed to the presence of coalition troops. Less than 1% believe the occupiers are responsible for any improvement in security. And for Iraq as a whole, 45% feel that attacks against your occupation forces are justified. That 80% figure was quietly confirmed in the regular analysis of the state of Iraq by the Brookings Institute in Washington last November. Well, very little information comes from press. This is the first war in memory that can barely be reported. The occupiers have created such a catastrophe, extraordinary catastrophe, that journalists simply can't go anywhere. They're almost all confined to the fortified U.S. Green Zone in Baghdad. If they go out, they're usually surrounded by Marines and Abrams tanks. And it's obvious enough, there are few exceptions, like Patrick Coburn, but very few. It's obvious enough what this means for the population. The professor of strategic studies at the U.S. Naval War College wrote that the post-invasion period has been a truly horrible and brutal one for hapless Iraq, with hatred of the United States now rampant, and a country subjected to years of sanctions that had already led to the destruction of the Iraqi middle class, the collapse of the secular educational system, and the growth of illiteracy, despair, and anomie that promoted an Iraqi religious revival among large numbers of Iraqis seeking succor in religion. Unfortunately, there's ample confirmation of these perceptions from Iraqi sources. In fact, Patrick Coben and others have pointed out correctly that the catastrophe in Iraq is one of the worst military catastrophes in military history. It's hard to think of an example like it for the population. Well, without going on, it's clear enough that the Iraqi calamity again illustrates the strong line of continuity, much as Thomas Carruthers had anticipated. And that shouldn't be surprising, given the unusual significance of Iraq in geopolitical and economic terms, and the fact that it should be obvious enough that a sovereign and moderately democratic Iraq could easily turn into an absolute nightmare for Washington and London. So it is no surprise that they're doing whatever they can to prevent it. In fact, the declarations of Iranian leaders are, though of course cynical, are much more credible than those coming from the West for this reason alone. Well, beyond declarations of leaders and the self-refuting case of Iraq, several additional bits of evidence have been put forward to justify our faith in the sincerity of the messianic mission of our grand leaders. The most heralded of them are Lebanon, Egypt, and Palestine. So let's turn to those. The case of Lebanon can be dismissed unless the CIA is taking credit for the car bombing that killed Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, which did set off anti-Syrian demonstrations and led to a complex but significant opening of Lebanese society. Apparently there were such speculations circulating in Beirut, and though I don't think they're credible, you can imagine why they might have some resonance in Beirut. Perhaps Lebanese have not forgotten the most horrendous car bombing in Beirut in 1985. That happened to be the year when Middle East terrorism had become so prominent in the West that it was ranked the most important story of the year in an annual poll of editors. They were relying on two cases, in each of which one person was killed, an American. The 1985 car bombing didn't enter the record, however. The car bombing caused a huge explosion, killed 80 people, wounded 200, mostly women and girls. They were leaving the mosque where the bomb had been placed. The attack was aimed at a Muslim cleric who escaped. It didn't figure in the poll. As I mentioned, it's out of Western history and mainstream scholarship on terrorism. For a good reason, it was traced to the CIA and Saudi intelligence, apparently with British help, which excludes it from the canon, naturally. Well, without pursuing the matter any further, we can surely exclude Lebanon from the cases that demonstrate the messianic mission. So let's turn to Egypt. There is a popular movement called Kifaya Enough, change, movement for change, in opposition to the U.S.-backed Musharraf, Mubarak, could have changed it, U.S.-backed Mubarak dictatorship. Musharraf would work too. The Kifaya movement was formed in the year 2000. It was largely sparked by the Palestinian Intifada. The leading elements in the Kifaya movement were these Palestinian solidarity groups, and the U.S.-backed Israeli atrocities in the occupied territories stimulated the Egyptian reform movement further. It was then joined by the huge opposition to the war in Iraq. The spokesperson for Kifaya stresses that it's an anti-imperial movement with goals extending beyond the democratization of Egypt. So the democratization movement in Egypt doesn't look like a very good candidate for the Messianic mission and its impact, so let's put that one aside. And that leaves the most heralded example, Washington's democratic promotion for Palestine. Let's have a look at that. These laudable efforts had been put on hold until the death of Yasser Arafat, which was celebrated as an opportunity for a realization of what the press calls Bush's vision of a democratic Palestinian state. Whatever it is, it's never been stated, it's some pale and vague reflection of the international consensus on a two-state settlement that the United States has blocked for 30 years and still does. The reasons for the new hopes were explained in a front-page New York Times think piece under the headline, Hoping Democracy Can Replace a Palestinian Icon. It's after Arafat died. The first sentence reads, the post-Arafat era will be the latest test of a quintessentially American article of faith, that elections provide legitimacy even to the frailest of institutions. And if you go down, read to the continuation page, and you get to the last paragraph, it says, the paradox for Palestinians is rich, however. In the past, the Bush administration resisted national elections among the Palestinians. The thought then was that the elections would make Mr. Arafat look better and give him a fresher mandate and might help give credibility and authority to Hamas. So in brief, the quintessential attitude of faith is that elections are just fine as long as they come out the right way. A year after the announcement, the formal announcement of the Messianic mission that set off the rush to the democratization bandwagon, a year after, the strong line of continuity is revealed once again, along with its paradoxical quality. Inexplicably, deeds consistently accord with interests and conflict with words, discoveries which must not, however, weaken our faith in the sincerity of our leaders. Again, North Korean style. The analogy is not quite exact. In North Korea, if you don't accept these doctrines, your faith can be pretty brutal. And in the West, there's no excuse for accepting the doctrines except cowardice and subordination of power. Bush proceeded to amplify his vision in Palestine by endorsing Israel's takeover of settlement blocks in the West Bank to solidify control over the region that the U.S. and Israel are now effectively incorporating beyond the separation wall. That's in defiance of a world court judgment that it violates international law. The U.S. Justice Bergenthal, he alone dissented from the world court judgment, but on very narrow grounds. He agreed with the court that the fourth Geneva Convention and international human rights laws are applicable to the occupied Palestinian territory and must therefore be faithfully complied with by Israel. And since all Israeli settlements in the occupied territories are in violation of the convention, he went on to say, the segments of the wall being built by Israel to protect the settlements are ipso facto in violation of international humanitarian law, about 80% of the wall. The same holds for other U.S.-backed Israeli actions to take over valuable land and resources, leaving the region fragmented, all blatantly illegal, quite uncontroversially, including the U.S. Justice of the World Court. The human significance of the current Bush-Sharon programs becomes very clear. If you take a look at the maps, I don't know about here, but in the United States, maps are scrupulously excluded from the meeting, taking too much. The basic plan consists of two salients extending from Israel through the West Bank. They create three virtually separated cantons, all of them virtually separated from whatever is to be left of East Jerusalem. It's the center of Palestinian commercial, cultural, and political life. These salients are to be incorporated within Israel, leaving the remaining fragments in Palestine isolated and unviable, with the expectation that the population will either leave or disappear from sight in something that will perhaps be called a state, with much self-congratulation in the West. Well, there's no time to review the diplomatic record of the 38 years of occupation, but it's so consistent and so extensively documented that it takes real dedication not to see or comprehend it. Now, the record reveals that the United States has unilaterally barred an overwhelming international consensus on a two-state political settlement, and still does, even more forcefully now than before, and now that it is guided by the president's inspiring vision. Now, there has, in fact, been one departure in this consistent rejectionism. Now, that was in late January 2001. That's the last month of Clinton's administration. For 1 week in January, high-level Israeli and Palestinian negotiators met in Taba, and they came fairly close to reaching an agreement that was approaching the international consensus. Israel called off the negotiations 4 days early so that their final outcome can only be guessed. Nevertheless, negotiations, formal negotiations, were not resumed, but they did continue unofficially at a fairly high level, leading to the announcement of the Geneva Accord in December of 2002. It was welcomed by most of the world, dismissed by Washington, hence the press, and rejected by Israel. So that's the end of that. The centerpiece of the Bush-Sharon programs for takeover of the West Bank is presented as a Gaza disengagement plan, which is supposed to offer new hopes for peace. The motives for disengagement are not obscure. Sane U.S.-Israeli rejectionists surely wanted Israel's illegal settlements removed from Gaza, which had been turned into a complete disaster area under the occupation. There were a few thousand Jewish settlers taking much of the land and the very scarce resources, and protected by a large part of the Israeli army. It's far more reasonable for U.S.-Israeli goals to leave Gaza as the largest and most overcrowded prison in the world, as Israeli human rights groups describe it, in which Palestinians can rot, largely cut off from contact with the outside by land, sea, or air, and very few means of sustenance. There was very little attempt to conceal the fact that the Gaza pullout was in reality an expansion plan. As the disengagement plan was made public, Israel's finance minister announced that Israel will invest tens of millions of dollars in West Bank settlements as it withdraws from the Gaza Strip. And Prime Minister Sharon announced new settlement blocks in the West Bank to be annexed to Israel. In fact, the disengagement plan, bother reading it, but it stated quite formally that the intention of the disengagement plan was to annex significant parts of the West Bank, any parts that are useful, arable land, water resources, within Israel. You take a look at this, at the map again, and you can see exactly what that means. Well, as you saw last August, and it's not obscure to scholarship, it's described accurately. As you saw last August, there was an enormous media blitz on disengagement. In fact, it manufactured one of the lead stories of the year. There was a huge deluge of reports and images depicting the pathos of families who who were forced to leave their homes and their greenhouses, weeping children trying vainly to hold back the soldiers, the anguish of the soldiers who were ordered to evict Jews from their homes, and also to remove the thousands of protesters who flooded to the settlement to resist the occupation, miraculously evading the military forces that keep an iron grip on Palestinians. Ignored, all that was ignored in the media extravaganza, and also was ignored was the fact, which is plain enough, that the disengagement last August 15 required no army intervention at all. The government could simply have announced that on August 15th, the Israeli army will leave Gaza, and a couple of weeks before, the settlers who had been subsidized to live there illegally would have quietly gotten into the lorries that were provided to them and would have departed to be subsidized again to live in the occupied West Bank and Golan Heights. But that wouldn't have sent the right message, namely, never again must Jews suffer such a terrible fate. The West Bank must be ours. Well, without proceeding, even the bare outlines make it clear enough that Palestine joins the other illustrations of Bush's messianic mission to bring peace and democracy and justice to the Middle East and to the world. The persistence of the strong line of continuity to the present reveals, again, that the United States is very much like other powerful states. It pursues the strategic and economic interests of dominant sectors of the domestic population to the accompaniment of impressive rhetorical flourishes about its exceptional dedication to the highest values. That's pretty close to a historical universal, and it's the reason why nobody with a brain cell functioning pays the slightest attention to the declarations of noble intent by leaders or the accolades by their followers. They're completely predictable, no matter what the facts. They carry no information, even in the technical sense, and the sensible person just disregards them. But that does not qualify you for entry into elite intellectual, respectable intellectual sectors. Well, it should be no surprise, again, that the evidence for Washington's dedication to the proclaimed messianic mission reduces to routine pronouncements of leaders, and that the counter evidence is mountains. Although the unanimity of the leap onto the democratization bandwagon is perhaps rather startling, and it's of no small significance for those who care about the state of democracy. Here I'm referring to Western democracy. The general principle is that abroad, democracy is fine, but only as long as it takes the top-down form doesn't risk popular interference with the primary interests of power and wealth. In fact, much the same doctrine holds internally. It's a topic of very great importance for Americans, of course, just as similar questions are important to you and everyone else in the West. The way the problems are dealt with in the United States, however, has much broader significance because of its extraordinary influence and power. No time to go into that matter in any detail here, but I'd like to end with a few words about the topic because it provides some simple and quite useful ideas as to how to approach the grave problems that confront all of us. Well, I wouldn't presume to make suggestions for Ireland. That's your task. But here are a few for the United States. One, accept the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court and the World Court. Two, sign the Kyoto Protocols and carry them forward. Three, let the United Nations take the lead in international crises. Four, rely on diplomatic and economic measures rather than military ones in confronting the grave threats of terror. Five, keep to a conservative interpretation of the United Nations Charter, meaning the use of force is legitimate only when ordered by the Security Council or when the country is under imminent threat of attack, and in accord with Article 51 of the Charter. 6, give up the veto at the Security Council and have a decent respect for the opinions of mankind, as the Declaration of Independence advises, even if power centers disagree. 7, cut back sharply on military spending and sharply increase social spending, meaning health, education, renewable energy, support for the United Nations, and so on. Well, for people who believe in democracy, that scattered few, these are very conservative suggestions for a very simple reason. These are the opinions of the majority of the U.S. population. In most cases, the overwhelming majority of the U.S. population. They're in radical opposition to public policy. In fact, both political parties are far to the right of the general population on these and many other major issues. Few citizens are aware of these facts, and there's a reason for that. Public opinion in the United States is studied very carefully. There are in-depth public opinion studies by the most prestigious institutions, but they are scarcely reported when they reveal such facts as these, sometimes not reported at all. And they regularly do. It's a highly instructive record. Well, these are far from the only constructive suggestions that one can think of. Another very conservative and useful suggestion is that facts should matter. Those who take the trouble to adhere to that suggestion will instantaneously abandon a good deal of standard doctrine. Just to take one example, an important one, the last years of the last millennium were disfigured by an extraordinary display of self-adulation on the part of Western elites for their magnificence and nobility. The two jewels in the crown were their humanitarian interventions in Kosovo and East Timor. In the case of Kosovo, there happens to be a huge mass of impeccable Western official documentation. It is extremely consistent. State Department, British Parliamentary Inquiry, OSCE, UN, and so on. Huge mass. It reveals unambiguously that the NATO bombing was not undertaken in response to the crimes, but rather precipitated the crimes, exactly as was anticipated. And it also reveals that diplomatic options that were available were ignored in the eagerness to rely on force that had nothing whatsoever to do with humanitarian intent. It's rather striking that in the huge literature on Kosovo, the Western documentation is ignored. Check and see. I mean, a few exceptions have written about it. But it's ignored, and the chronology is reversed, so that the bombing turns out to be in reaction to the crimes instead of to have precipitated the crimes, as anticipated. Uncontroversial. Check and see. The case of East Timor, I won't mention, is just grotesque. The fact that that hideous example can even be brought up in this connection is an astonishing comment on the moral depravity to which intellectual commentary has sunk. Again, documentation is very rich and easily accessible, although, exactly as in the case of the democracy promotion, it's much easier to repeat the standard mantras, especially when they're very self-serving. It's a pathology of the educated classes throughout history, and with very few exceptions. Well, in brief, there are some very simple steps that can be taken to move to a much better world. One of them is take democracy seriously. Another is to pay attention to fact and elementary moral principles. Another is to refuse to accept the self-serving contention of the powerful that what has happened in the past can be forgotten, boring ancient history, because in our magnificence, we have undergone a miraculous change of course. That's something that happens every few years. And other simple truths. They don't answer every problem by any means, but they do carry us quite a long way toward developing more specific and detailed answers as is constantly done by activists and people close to them. And much more important, they open the way to implementing such proposals. These are opportunities that are readily within our grasp if we can free ourselves from the shackles of doctrine and imposed illusions.